Welcome back to an episode of Talking Smack Without Josh. And you know what that means? That's right. That means that Josh is currently up in Green Bay inspecting training camp and making sure those Packers are right in line. I also hear that he's making pleas to special units part of the Packers. He really wants them on the podcast. But that's okay, because that means I have my trustworthy buddy, my ride or die, Justin Henson of the Movie Wire and Back to the Balcony. Justin, how are you today?
You're a dick. You are an you are a son of a. You know, I was planning on a comfortable time, maybe nighttime, a nighttime podcast talking about Disclosure Day, maybe with a few bourbons in me with the lights turned down. But it would have been a nice discussion. But instead, you had to spring at the last minute. Hey, I didn't see Disclosure Day, but you can come on the show and tell us how it is. And by the way, we can discuss Death of a Unicorn and Thrash. And oh, by the way, can you do it at 8 a.m? So instead of comfortably having a movie discussion with some drinks, it is now in the wee hours of the morning while I burn off my drinks from the previous night, watching movies that you should have already reviewed. I am drinking a espresso right now on a podcast talking movies. Do you understand? I drank more rewatching these movies last minute, like 6 hours ago, just because you have never seen them. And now I had to set a alarm for 6:30 in the morning so we could have a discussion about two mediocre movies that nobody cares about. Talking Smack owes me on this one. I mean, firstborn. For the first time, my desk has a bottle of water and a double espresso on it. This isn't normal in this room.
I will make it up to you. Next time we see each other in person, I will buy you an espresso martini.
Fair. I will take it.
Okay. But yes, as Justin so eloquently just said, giving me the Steve Martin treatment in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I unfortunately have not seen Disclosure Day yet, and Josh isn't going to see it either. And that's actually part of the discussion we want to have, is ambivalence towards cinema at this time. And whether that is necessarily director, actor, writer choice, what is it about the promotion that makes us kind of go like, Because normally you see the name Spielberg and you see Emily Blunt, you see Kof, the writer, and you have all this desire to rush out and see something. I mean, heck, Emily Blunt is in one of the biggest movies of the year. Devil Wears Prada 2, a legacool that, you know, was shocking. And one, how good it was. But two, how tremendous it's been. But before we get to that, I want to talk to some cheerful people who won't curse at me. Our friends over at Sugar Coated Murder.
Hey, Ann Barner.
Hey, Karen Beatty.
We need a promo. You know, like where we talk about what we do on our podcast.
On our Sugar-Coated Murder podcast? Like how we love to bake and talk about murder?
That's what we need to talk about.
There you go.
I think we've talked about it. Y'all find us on all your favorite listening apps.
Stay sweet.
And don't murder.
Because if you kill people,
we will talk about you.
I think they're telling me to murder you.
You know, if you want them to talk about you. The three of us have talked about this movie off air and on air, I think once or twice leading up to the release of it, because Spielberg is, I mean, it's been overwrought, a titan of cinema. He is. He, with Amblin Productions, he has produced Our Childhood with Animaniacs and numerous other cartoons. He has had this, and he doesn't have his finger on the pulse. He had a stranglehold on the pulse of the world for 30, 40 years at least. He had a great TV movie in Duel, which was it Goldie Hawn. Goldie Hawn was Sugarland Express. But he had Sugarland Express, which was kind of a smaller film with Goldie Hawn, who was coming off of all those TV shows and panel shows she did and had her own heat to her. He then did Jaws in 75, and he had an unparalleled streak. Yes, there were misses in there, but you're talking Jaws, Close Encounters, Raiders, E.T., Indiana Jones, The Color Purple, which was criminal that got nominated for, 10 Academy Awards and didn't win a single.
Yep.
Empire of the Sun, which people say is underrated and had young Christian Bale in it, as well as Miranda Richardson, came back. And he does this occasionally where he just pops in and does two films in 1 year. So he did The Last Crusade and then Always. Always is the last film with Audrey Hepburn. And that movie is very saccharine and very sweet. Not quite what you expect from Spielberg, but still a good movie. It's criminally underrated. He has Hook, which people like to crap on, but Hook was great. And then he did two sets of twofers. 93, he had Jurassic Park, Schindler's List. Four years later, he did Jurassic Park, Lost World, and Amistad. Settled in, Saving Private Ryan. And this is maybe when you can say some of the cracks were starting to appear, because I loved AI. AI was a Kubrick film. Kubrick had passed away shortly after delivering his cut of Eyes Wide Shut, a famously painful shoot with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise that they shot for like a year straight, sometimes doing like 1,000 takes of one scene, because Kubrick is just that kind of person, or he's a photographer first. And if every single frame per second doesn't look how he wants, he has to do it again. And I remember the backlash, reading about that backlash to AI, and I was 15 or 16 years old. My girlfriend and I went and saw it, cried the entire time. But the backlash to AI was that this is not, Spielberg cannot be Kubrick. It's like, well, fuck no, of course they can't. But they were good friends. And then there was like accusations that Spielberg changed the ending because Kubrick would have never had a hopeful ending like that. And Spielberg's like, here's literally the shooting draft that he said he wanted to do. This is his ending. And then he kind of pivoted. He went back, did Minority Report, and Catch Me If You Can, another twofer. Both amazing movies, huge movies those years. Popped back, went to a kind of a safe place with The Terminal with Tom Hanks. Did another twofer, back Tom Cruise with War of the Worlds. Went to Munich. Munich, again, was a film that people were starting to say he's losing his touch. He used to have a deft hand. And then the last 21 years, he's kind of disappeared. I mean, yes, he had Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, but there was so much backlash to that. Adventures of Tintin, which we've been promised a sequel for 15 years now, and he's threatening another one. He said, hey, Jackson and I just talked. We're really going to shoot it this year. War Horse, Lincoln, got his Oscars for Lincoln. Bridge of Spies, The Big Friendly Giant, which should have been this beautiful return to like childhood nostalgia, but post Ready Player One, which again, we were promised with Ready Player One, hey, this is Spielberg back to summer, big blockbuster. It's been like 12 years. Spielberg's back, baby. Came and went. People were like, Spielberg shouldn't have been the one to do this. Too many of the films that he referenced in that movie are his films. You loved West Side Story and The Fablemans. Neither did anything for me. This is 4 years later. Again, we're being told Spielberg's back. Disclosure Day, big summer blockbuster. He's returned to Aliens. Here we are. We're back. He's settled in. We're doing Aliens again, guys. First time he's touched Aliens in 40 years. This, and all the reviews that I've seen, because it was pretty well reviewed according to Rotten Tomatoes, but it all seems to be, to me, damning with faint praise. And unfortunately, the early box office is well under what they expected. They're thinking 35, 40 for US, worldwide a total of maybe 60. And Josh and I have been trying to just drum up interest and trying to drum up desire to see this film. So I want to talk with you about, like, Spielberg shaped our childhood. The shows he's produced, the movies he's made, my love of cinema. I started reading adult books because I saw Jurassic Park and I went, am I going to go home and read Goosebumps? No, I want to read this thing called Jurassic Park that I've read dozens of times. And every time I read it, I get something new out of it, especially as a child. Like half the words I don't understand because goddamn you, Michael Crichton. But why do you think I have this ambivalence? And maybe even the audience has ambivalence to Spielberg.
It goes back to just nostalgia, right? Because when we had, let's take the most popular, I would say, Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
When we were kids, 11-year-old for me, we didn't go for Spielberg. Once we walked out, we knew the Spielberg name. We knew what he was going to present. And it almost stays with us when we see that name popped on screen, where we're just hoping for that one feeling. And people probably had the same experience with Jaws going into Jurassic Park, hoping for that same feeling, or Close Encounters, all of E.T., whatever it may be. He has a way in his early movies to really trigger that nostalgia. And I think it's mainly because he puts his own nostalgia in a lot of these early movies to give the adventure feel, to give the excitement. So now when we hear Spielberg, it's almost cross our fingers, bring those feelings back to the theater. I want my early childhood to be seen on that screen. I want those early feelings that I had as a kid. And I think that's really hard for any filmmaker. You know, we've had this discussion before. Does actors or actresses put butts in seats? I say no. But there are people out there that are going to go to every, I don't know, Emily Blunt movie, Meryl Streep movie, whatever it may be. So when it goes to Spielberg, this is the danger when we get a movie like Disclosure Day. You can look at it two different ways. Is you can go in and set the standard. Critics do it all the time, and we're hearing it a lot with a lot of reviews of this is a Spielberg movie or it's not a Spielberg movie. We have to look at film at face value of what it's presenting. If you would have shown this movie with none of the cast or credits, honestly, how would this movie make you feel without setting the bar super high? So again, I had trouble going into Disclosure Day because it was hard to get out of my own skin to say, I'm going to look at this movie at face value. Because again, I'm one of those that bring me that childhood feeling, bring me that wonder, bring me that curiosity, bring me that mystery. Because the trailer even teased at old Spielbergian mystery and curiosity that we kind of got from Close Encounters. So that got my hopes high for this movie.
I don't know if this is a tactical decision by media, but I've seen people recently, news reports, articles, whatever, people not saying this is a Spielbergian movie, but this is an Amblin movie. Amblin is his production company, right? And because we heard like J.J. Abrams, how much J.J. Abrams was inspired by Spielberg and that you can see in some of his shots and the way he's choosing things. But now what I'm hearing is the movie is coming out later this year about dinosaurs attacking a suburbia, the end of Bleecker Street, I think it's called.
Cloverfield spinoff.
Yeah, it's a Cloverfield spinoff. But I hear people saying, oh, this is like an early Amblin film. I'm like, what's the Amblin? And like, oh, right, right. Which makes me kind of wonder, is Spielberg partially involved with that? That's like, hey, listen, stop saying it's a Spielberg film. Start saying it's Amblin because Amblin will live on when I retire. You know, he is 79 now. There was an article I read years ago and I'm looking at Orson Welles because Orson Welles was a name. Orson Welles did Citizen Kane. That was his stepped up, out of the box, Citizen Kane, first thing he did. Massive film for him, but not necessarily the box office because of the whole politics behind it. And then he was working on his other films, The Magnificent Ambersons, The Stranger, Lady from Shanghai, Othello and Macbeth, Touch of Evil. For a long time, he was trying to do The Other Side of the Wind. But nothing ever really took off for him because he was shut out of Hollywood in many ways because of the powers of the papers back then. I was reading this article about him later in life where he and Spielberg sat down and had dinner together. And Orson Welles was trying to pitch Spielberg on, hey, I have this film coming up. You have all this power. You're the young guy like I was. And Orson Welles got mad because all Spielberg wanted to talk to him about was what he used to do. How did you get this shot? How did you do this? Tell me about your history. Oh, this movie. It got so volatile that he felt that he was being treated as the old man. That when Rosebud, the sled from Citizen Kane, came up for auction and Spielberg bought it, Orson Welles then put out a release saying, that's not the real one. I burned the real one. That's just a copy. And he apparently took that back some years later. Is Spielberg's nostalgia, which he was really great at, I mean, I think about it. He has classic shots. A Spielberg shot is a low angle door frame. Somebody opens it. It's pointed up. There's light coming through it. He does that so much. And he is great with perspective because he makes even adults feel small. And that small can either be fear or that small can be hope and wonder. And so often he goes for hope and wonder so that when he does do the fear shots, you feel it. But is Spielberg's style of nostalgia passing us by? Are we in that later years of like Hitchcock films? Hitchcock had the pulse on things for what, 20 years almost? But by the time you're entering the late 60s, I mean, who really went to see Topaz and Frenzy?
you know, I don't think we're past that. And again, especially at Disclosure Day, it's going to be open for interpretation, right? But there is a danger of nobody can be successful. Nobody's going to have every movie be successful. And the wants of the audience are going to outpower the filmmaker. And it's never going to be a win-win. And when it comes to Disclosure Day, I don't find this an Amblin film because there are a lot of Spielberg in this movie. And you see it more prominent in the back half of the movie than you do in the first half. It's almost like where he's trying to merge his couple of styles from the early 2000s of a lot of this rustic shots, a lot of shots you've seen in Lincoln, Munich. And then it kind of goes into a Spielberg style. So this one, it almost tries to appease both sides of the aisle of what kind of Spielberg you're looking for. But at the end of the day, it's art. It's a story that is being told. So it shouldn't matter who's doing it. And that's what really drives me nuts. And I go back, when I wrote my review for this movie, it actually brought me back. And I remember I was 11 years old and we spent 3 weeks trying to see Jurassic Park. And I remember watching, don't quote me on the show or the critic, but I think it was Good Morning America with Leonard Maltin as a guest critic reviewing this. And he said that it takes a while for this movie to get going. But once the dinosaurs are in, then it starts to cook. And that's the first impression. And we even look at Siskel and Ebert, who say the characters are not memorable. They gave it a marginal pass. So
really?
Both of these critics at face value, and again, memorable characters, that hasn't aged well. But when we look at Good Morning America's review, we're talking 23 minutes. That's not a long time in a two-hour movie to get an introduction going. To introduce characters, and they forget that the dinosaurs were only in the movie for less than 15 minutes. So that at face value, that's how good Spielberg is he can convince critics, ones that are looking for this kind of stuff, saying, huh, okay, once the dinosaurs are in, it gets cooking. They're only in for 15 minutes, and it was only 20 minutes, right? So I think we see that a lot here. We see that a lot with some of his films, that we set the expectation, and you know, you're expecting something from Spielberg and you're missing key pieces of the movie where, you know what? If dinosaurs were that overpowering in the characters, you would have noticed they're not in there that long. So, and I think that is a really key part of even going into Disclosure Day.
Makes sense. Since you mentioned critics, I should mention Gene Shalit passed last night, and Gene Shalit is 100 years old. Youngins, you may not remember him because he was the critic for NBC on the Today Show, primarily in the morning. But you've seen parodies of him, big, wild, kind of like fluffy, curly, afro-y hair, a mustache that extends basically to each shoulder blade, and eyebrows that can make Groucho Marx blush. He was famous for his puns and quips. He loved just twisting little tales while telling while giving his reviews. He's wonderful critic, known for his personality, and kind of sucked on his opinions at times. But hey, I mean, at least you were entertained with listening to him talk about stuff.
He was in the prime of critics, so I mean, you had two main critics that you just mimicked, right? Gene Shalit and of course Siskel and Ebert. But Gene Shalit was so easy, and you know what, just like any critics, you're not going to agree 100% of the time. But damn it, it's hard to disagree when you're seeing that fro just waving in front of the camera. He was an incredible critic because he can articulate and he can really portray a picture for even the worst movie, and sometimes in a positive way.
Now, kids, you may remember he's Gene Scallop on SpongeBob. He was on a few episodes. But yeah, he's definitely from the era where critics became personalities. Siskel and Ebert, for 25, 30 years, their thumbs up or thumbs down mattered. Unless it was for a horror film. They hated horror films. But back to Disclosure Day, I guess part of the reason why I feel there was a bit of lack of confidence in this film from the production company is the last trailer gave us a money shot. I think it's an amazing shot. I loved it. My problem was with the shot is that it looks too artificial when I expect Spielberg to feel real. There's this beautiful shot in the last trailer right before they show the title where you've seen these very CGI deers throughout the different trailers walking into houses with birds and stuff like that. And it has this intense close-up of this deer's eye, and then it begins to pan around the head with the fur and all that. And as it does, it melds into this giant alien eye. And it says this closure. Beautiful shot. That is a Spielberg shot. That is him knowing exactly what his storyboard is. He's like, this is my money shot. This is where I reveal and make the audience gasp. It's like seeing the T-Rex for the first time in Jurassic Park. Yeah, you get the little hints of it because it was, you know, chewing on the goat. But when it actually rips through the power lines and steps through and you feel the power of it, that's his baby. But to give that away in the trailer makes me feel like they were desperate to tell people, no, this is an alien movie. We are going to have aliens. There'll be aliens. We promise there's aliens. You're gonna get something. It's not going to be War of the Worlds where you're going to briefly see a dead alien. It's not going to be Close Encounters where it's going to be some lights. Like, no, we're aliens. But what did you think of this film? Should I see this film? That's the thing, is like, I want my ambivalence and my worry to be pushed away and somebody I trust to be like, no, you should see this in theaters.
Well, here's the deal. And even as I was writing the review, I was going back and forth where I didn't even know where I was going to go with my rating. But I spoke to it earlier. It depends on how you walk in, if you can leave Spielberg at the door and take it at face value. But I'll start with the negatives because you already pissed me off being up so early. So I have to go negative first. I don't understand lately the trend of stretching a premise to 2.5 hours where we have the second act trying to put together messaging, trying to put together the why, and leaving that at the door at the climax. So to me, this movie could have been shorter. It's a 2.5 hour car chase scene. That's what it is. And what's disappointing about that is again, based on what I just said, this can come back and bite me in the ass, but the characters are not interesting. All we have our characters doing is running, driving a car, and I'm being very careful not to spoil anything, so I'm trying to be vague. It's like one of those where we wait for the reveal of Spielberg, of Jaws, the T-Rex in Jurassic Park, the aliens in Close Encounters, whatever it may be. We're waiting for that big reveal, and here it's not earned, or it's a letdown. It really does just kind of spin its tires until it finds transition to get where it wants to go. But I will say this, the performances are fantastic. But that's where the double-edged sword is with this, is because we have a lot of side characters. Coleman Domingo, who does a fantastic job, who has this side story almost where he has to be the home base of our characters. They have to get to Domingo. Or why? We don't know. That's why it kind of just hints during the second act, and we just get them on a cross-country just race. So I think it really does drag quite a bit. But here's the good, is like I said, the performances are fantastic. The second half, mesmerizing. And I will say I saw this at 11 o'clock showing, and I didn't check my clock once. It does go. So, but I think that's part of it, is don't read reviews, don't go in with expectations, and just kind of let it take you on the journey. But the climax is going to be there for, you're either going to love it, you're going to hate it. And especially if you're related to a lot of the trailers, it's going to go either way. For me, I thought the climax, the movie should have spent a lot more time on the wonder of the climax than the 12th car chase scene that we saw. It wasn't necessary. But if I had to rate the first half of it, I'd give it 2 stars. If I had to rate the second half of it, even though satisfying climax, even though I have issues with it, I'd give it 3, 3.5. So it's one of those that I would say, see it. It's a great experience, but you have to leave Spielberg at the door. You have to leave your expectations at the door and just kind of go along for the ride on it. It does a lot right. Even Spielberg's direction, again, we can see a mixed match of his styles from early Spielberg to his early 2000s Spielberg. So it does feel like almost two separate directions to an extent. But once we see Domingo with the lights in the back giving a speech, you're like, that's my Spielberg. That's the Spielberg I've been waiting for. So I think this movie can go back and forth. Did it blow me away? Absolutely not. I think people going into it are being too generous with it because it does have a lot of flaws, especially if you just look at the second act that really doesn't go anywhere. It really focuses on the why without telling us the why. We don't really know where it's going to go, and it just really just spins its tires. So take out a lot of the car chase scenes. You probably have a solid hour 50, 2 hour movie.
Yeah.
I can't say go see it. You got to buy a ticket to it, but I think people will enjoy it if you leave your expectations.
That actually might have been enough because I don't mind going to films. I enjoy the theaters, especially since the Bullet Classic Theater is so great. And I feel my time is respected there because of the middle mount trailers. The seats don't suck. It smells nice when you walk in. But if I'm going to go see a movie, I want to feel respected by the creator. Which leads me to the two films that I wanted to mention to you. Because I remember your reviews and I'm like, Justin just doesn't know how to have fun. And occasionally I feel like you don't know how to have fun.
Screw you.
So in the last few weeks, I have watched with my spouse Death of a Unicorn and Thrash. I would like to briefly start with Death of a Unicorn. Death of a Unicorn by Alex Scarfman, starring Paul Rudd, Jenna Ortega, Will Poulter, Tia Leone, and Richard E. Grant. Paul Rudd is a piece of crap. Whose wife passed away a few years back. He's a lawyer at this sinister company, and his daughter, who has really bad acne and is in college, he drags her along to a mysterious meeting up in the hills to become basically the facilitator of the CEO's will, and the CEO's family is there. Of course, we have Richard E. Grant as Odell, CEO. We have Will Poulter as the son. Tia Leone as Belinda, the much younger and obviously only in it for the money wife. And there's a smattering of people who are scientists and staff. This movie started off with so much promise because they set up the conflict so well. He's haggard. He's trying. Paul Rudd's haggard. He's trying to get the paperwork together. His daughter is sleeping on his shoulder, and he drops the paperwork. Couldn't just ask somebody to hand him his paperwork from the aisle. No, because it's not like people are going to step on it. It's in the middle of the aisle. They're going to reach down and hand it to him. No, he makes the decision to yank his shoulder away so she bangs her head. They then hit a unicorn because he has allergies and he's sneezing, bleeding, snotting all over the place. And they quickly find out after beating the unicorn to death with a crowbar that the unicorn's blood has some healing properties because his allergies and eyes clear up, her acne clears up. But the daughter got a chance to bond with the unicorn by grabbing its horn, which I swear is a sexual metaphor. And then the family finds out about it because the unicorn, of course, has healing properties and can't be beat to death with a crowbar. And basically, hell breaks loose because healing properties, terminally ill old man, rich people, scientists, cabin in the woods, more unicorns. It all sounds great. It sounds like a tremendous time. I was so happy for parts of this movie. Tia Leone being an absolute jerk, only in it for the money, and then her husband all of a sudden de-ages and is better, and she's just like, screw it, we're going to be even richer. Even better. Will Poulter as the son who has no original idea for himself, but he's trying to impress his dad. So literally every person with an idea, he's trying to make them give him a PowerPoint so he can understand it. So he can steal their idea. Great. But then it falls apart through the sloppiest execution I can think of. And the part that got me, how sloppy it was, is Paul Rudd is willing to sacrifice himself to protect his daughter at the end because it turns out unicorns are vengeful when you kill them and like kidnap them and beat them. their parents are coming for them. And then Paul Rudd is about to sacrifice himself and Jenna Ortega leaps from a balcony in the middle of the night and lands on the ground in broad daylight noon. And I paused it, tabbed back and went, night, 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 night. And I looked at my wife and went, is there supposed to be some kind of sequence here? And she went, that's really, did they reshoot all this? I have no clue what the theme of this movie is, because Paul Rudd deserved to die. He does, but he gets brought back, of course. Will Poulter kind of deserves to die. He does. I don't understand the theme of this movie. This movie is trying to find a message and has no confidence in what that message is.
Well, I gave it 2.5 when it originally came out because of that. Because it can't figure out what tone it wants. It can't figure out what style it wants to be. It feels like two separate movies. But here's where the biggest problem is with this movie, is that we don't hate the characters like we should.
No.
All the characters, you take the family, they're rich, they're greedy, but you kind of understand. You got a Richard E. Grant, who's a sick old man that wants to be healed. How can we hate this guy? You have Poulter, that's just a moron, and you have Tay Leone, that, you know what, I get it, she wants money, but there's nobody that you really hate.
Exactly.
It gets to the point where everybody starts to die and you're just like, I don't care. I'm like, that sucks. And it tries to go for the gross factor, where you do have some, like, the hoof smashing ahead, but it cuts away just in time. And then randomly, the movie just goes, you know what? We really don't like Leone. Let's just have her had the most gruesome kill possible. So let's lay her on a table and have her intestines fall out with the horse eating it. So even the death scenes aren't consistent. And you're right, the editing is horrible. But Poulter snorting it like cocaine. I absolutely love the unicorn cocaine.
It's hysterical.
But they don't lean into a lot of this humor. It just kind of just is linear, and it just can't figure out what kind of tone it went. I felt like we needed a Death to Smoochie kind of tone, because it kind of has those purple elements that we kind of feel it should be really, really dark. And we get elements of that. But then it kind of goes into, I'm referencing Jurassic Park a lot on this episode, but we do get kind of like some shots like that where we get the lights coming back behind the woods as they're hunting. You get the medical tarps where you see the shadow of the unicorn.
Love it
gets different elements that you're just like, make up your goddamn mind of what you want to do. You have a pretty decent cast here. Do something with them.
I really feel like there's just a lack of confidence in what the presentation was supposed to be, because, as you said, everyone's likable. Tia Leone, I mean, even like the way she's manipulating Jenna Ortega's character with the whole, like, that's so right, honey. You're right. We need to protect this. And who better than us? You know us. We have our scientists. It's perfect. Richard E. Grant just wants to live. And then when they're like making deals, like, there's only like enough for 12 people. We got to make sure it's the right people while they're drinking it, like the blood out of martini glasses.
And they're eating it.
They're eating it.
I mean, gross. They're eating horse meat.
Yeah. It was so close to being so good, but the last 30 minutes just dropped the ball of like, what were they trying to say?
Nothing. They ran out of money and they needed to wrap it up quick.
Yeah, it only had like a $13 million budget. And Tia Leone, Paul Rudd, Jenna Ortega, Richard E. Grant, Will Portia, those are not cheap names. And even if you were doing just, it was a very confined spot. It was an airplane and a car and then the house, you know?
Well, look at it this way. You have a damn unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever feel like you were in awe of this unicorn? Did you ever feel, even when they tried to make it scary? No, I was waiting for a rainbow to shoot out of the fucking horn, and we don't even get that. It's one of those where you have a horse with a horn. That's all that's here. There's nothing magical. You get more magic from the unicorn coming from snorting its horn dust than you do anything else.
Justin, I have a movie that I was so mad at you when you reviewed it. It's called Thrash. It is by Tommy Wirkola, who wrote and directed Dead Snow about World War II zombies being unfrozen. Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. Fun but dumb. Dead Snow 2. Fantastic. What Happened on Monday? It's an all right film. Violent Night. You loved Spermageddon.
Loved it.
Again, written directed by them. They're filming right now Violent Night 2, but then we have Thrash, a shark film in like Louisiana, Category 5. Dejonamon Hunsu and a bunch of no-name people who I don't recognize. And I was loving this film because the main actress is Whitney Peak, who has agoraphobia after something happened with her mother. And so she just lives in this house, doesn't really leave. and she is competent. For a shark film, she is incredibly competent. And she has to eventually defend this pregnant woman who is trapped in the who's trapped by the hurricane. And there's great things. This is a creature feature. This is perfect. This is a B movie. This is a Saturday morning reel. This is something Mystery Science Theater or Sci-Fi Channel would be airing continuously. Because you have sharks. You have a tank full of blood that you set up that is transporting blood through town. Everything about this is set up perfectly. You have great moments where the blood draws all the hammerhead sharks into town. You have the houses flooding. You have the woman trapped by sharks, people getting eaten. You think there's supposed to be a romance there. Nope, dead person. You have Whitney Peake's character manipulating the sharks with little vibrating toys and stuff to draw it away. You have Djarmin Hensu, a marine researcher, talking about the big shark. It's a pregnant woman, pregnant shark who's coming into town. They've been tracking that. It's like killing things as it goes. You have all these things being set up of like to try to pull off a Jaws-esque scenario or at least a really bad creature film. It was set up so perfectly. And this movie's 86 minutes long with credits. Right at the point where we're like, he shows up to save his niece. And we get the big one. We've been promised the big shark. The big shark's been coming through town. The big pregnant lady is in town. And I'm like, all right, we're going to have researcher and his competent niece. And we're going to have a throwdown in this little powerboat against the big shark. Oh, yeah. Credits. Because the big shark saves her life. Because it's about family. It's about motherhood. The mother shark defended the pregnant woman giving birth in the water from the hammerheads. And then they were rescued and sail off into safety. And then it has the balls to tease us that another storm is incoming. I was so mad at you. I was watching this thinking like, man, Justin just hates fun. And it's just going and going. I'm like so excited. And then when it cuts to that, I went, Justin was 100% correct. And I should apologize to him. So Justin, I am so sorry. You were correct about Thrash.
Lesson learned. Well, here's the deal. It's a great shark film if it didn't have the sharks in it. I think there is a lot of interesting things. And I even said it in my review. It has all the people elements that work. I love the agoraphobia aspect of it. I love the characters. Again, the characters are set up in scenarios where it's a little outlandish, but I love the different stories being told. But right when the sharks get in, I'm like, come the fuck on. It's like they know exactly where to go. They know exactly who needs to kill. They know exactly who the asshole dad is to kill. So yep. It's one of those. And then Hansu is wasted in this movie. He's the biggest noticeable talent. He does a decent enough job and he is just wasted. You can tell he's in a shit movie because you can see a decrescendo of him just not caring. The climax is absolutely ridiculous. It goes really hardcore B movie within the last like 10, 15 minutes. But the rest of the movie, there's some interest. It's too interesting to even be classified as a B movie because the characters, I think, are really well designed. I wouldn't say the dialogue's that great, but they're well designed. So, yeah, I gave it a 2-star on it just because of that. But honestly, I should reclassify it because if it's trying to be a shark movie, then I would have given it a 1.5.
I agree with you because there were moments in this where we were like expecting it to fall to like really campy B movie territory because there's a part where Winnie Peake's character is going to go rescue the pregnant woman who's trapped in her car with sharks surrounding her. And she grabs like a butcher knife but she slips down the roof and falls into the water. And we're like, well, how has she not stabbed herself? And they reveal it because she took the knife, turned it sideways, used it, like looped it to her belt so that it's flat and against her. I'm like, oh, that's smart. And, you know, her tricks to kind of lure the sharks away and the other things she's doing and how she's just prepping and working with. I don't know. I was so excited. We would have gotten the payoff at the end of a big shark battle. It would have been great. But instead, they just pulled back and walked away. And I really think that there was like a 10-minute shark battle. And as they're filming this, it's like, oh, it's like part of the set flooded. Okay, we lost a day here. Oh, we lost this day here. Oh, okay, like what distribution pulled out? Oh, crap. And then so they cut it off because it's 86 minutes with credits. Doesn't even crawl to the 90-minute mark. And then they do a little teaser. It's like, can we just have someone filmed in like a studio looking at the monitor going, oh, no, something's coming. That way, if we Netflix gives us $20 million, one person watches it, they'll give us a sequel.
It almost conned me into believing it, because we do have that scene towards the climax of the birth scene in the house.
Yeah.
And right then, I'm just like, oh, shit. And it's the only moment that I actually had my eyes glued to the screen for a brief moment, because the water's coming up, there's blood in the water, there's a baby in danger, which is horrifying.
Yep.
And that had me on the edge of my seat, not for the characters per se, but just for the baby.
Yep.
But everything else is trash. It should be called trash, not thrash.
Well, Justin, I need to roll on out of here and go see Disclosure Day. So why don't you tell us where we can find you?
You can follow me anywhere you listen to podcasts at The Movie Wire. You can also check out the Cult-Worthy Cinema podcast and Movie Wire's crossover show, Back to the Balcony, available on YouTube now. And you can also check me out on all the socials and at themoviewire.com.
Speaking of themoviewire.com, T-Smack Pod is up. It doesn't look great. It is we're still drafting now, but you can find our socials there. You can find our episodes there. And Josh and I are starting a weekly blog, and I put together just a kind of free-flowing thought on my favorite movie of the year thus far, Obsession.
Good pick.
We're going to have another episode talking about that. But yes, thank you, Leo Allen, for musical themes, Beppo and Richard Studio for avatars. You can follow us at T-Smack Pod. And oh my God.
You just do a Jar Jar Binks thing?
Yes. T-Smack Pod is where you can find us on socials. You can join our Discord, the link below, tsmackpod@gmail.com. You can also email us, talk to us. And Justin, what is your favorite Spielberg film?
I'm going to have to go with my childhood nostalgia of Jurassic Park.
Damn right you are. See y'all next week, everyone.